My name is Michelle Mahoney, and I am with EPA's Superfund program. I think I'm going to get started on some housekeeping items for today's Clue-In webinar while we wait for other people to log in. So again, I'd like to welcome everyone to today's internet webcast on, it's basically part of our Superfund redevelopment initiative series, and our title today is Food for Thought, Gardening on Superfund Sites. And this webinar is being sponsored by EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Michelle Mahoney, as I said, and I am with EPA, and I'm going to moderate today's session. I'll also be giving a couple presentations. We're going to get started in a few moments. While we wait for others, I'm going to walk you through some housekeeping. So when you registered for the webinar, you were directed to the seminar-specific URL, which is the front page of today's webinar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We've also have some bio sketches of the presenters, and also the presenters' email addresses are hot linked on that page, so in case you have any questions for one of them after today's presentation, you'll be able to get and hold them from that page. I have globally muted all of the phone lines today to avoid any disruption in our broadcast. We will be taking questions using the internet question mark icon in the webcast. So if you do have a question at any point during the webinar, please just submit them online and we will read them aloud to the audience at the question period. So by now, all of you should have clicked on the agenda for today and at the go-to session icon, and you should be on slide number one of the presentation. This is the main page, and it basically contains the slides, above which you'll see some orange navigation icons. You may be able, you can submit questions at any time during the webcast using the question mark icon, and you'll see this above the slide. You don't need to wait until the question and answer period to submit your question, and we'd like it if you would just submit them as you think of them so that we're ready to go and ask questions during the Q&A session. If you experience any technical difficulties with the audio stream, you can also use the question mark icon, and this will alert us of your technical difficulty. We ask that you include a phone number where you can be reached so we can try to help you troubleshoot your problem. As the presenters move through, they're going to announce the number of the slide on which they're moving to, and you can advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. So we're going to have a few question sessions. At the end of the presentation, you'll see our links for more information page. We've assembled some, documents and other things related to today's topic that you can take a look at. All this information stays with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We do archive our seminars with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. And we do have an online feedback form at the end that we ask that you consider filling out because we do look at your comments as we try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms of our webinars. So with the housekeeping items out of the way, I think we're ready to kick off our session. I'm going to turn it over to Melissa Friedland, who's the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Coordinator here at headquarters. And she's going to give us a presentation and move into the next speakers.
Thanks, Michelle. Good afternoon, everybody. I thank you all for joining us today for a discussion on this exciting topic. And right at the outset, I'd particularly like to thank my co-presenters, Michelle Mahoney, Stephanie Swick, Chris Choi, and Mark Mataloni, for taking the time to talk with us about the great work they're doing. I'm moving on to slide four. As we get started, I'd like to provide a quick glimpse of how we're going to spend our time this afternoon. So I'll begin with an introduction to our topic, and then we'll move on to our other presenters who will share information about how to approach urban gardening in as safe a way as possible. Michelle, Stephanie, and Chris will present some tools and resources that are available to help folks explore urban gardening at their site. And then Michelle will highlight some sites that are supporting urban garden activities, and Mark will follow with some useful information for gardeners about lead exposure pathways. I'll conclude with some tools that SRI can provide to help communities get started. So I'm moving on to slide five. As Michelle mentioned, I'm the Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment, which means I head up the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI. Our mission here at SRI at both national and regional levels is to work with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. I'll talk in more detail later in the presentation about one specific area of our work as it relates to urban gardening, but if you're interested in learning more about SRI, I encourage you to visit our website, which is listed at the bottom of this slide, or contact me, and I'll give my contact information at the end of the presentation. So, going on to slide six. In the next few slides, I'd like to show you a few examples of some of the more innovative types of reuse that we're seeing. But as we go through these examples, just please keep in mind that there are so many different types of ways to reuse Superfund sites. So there's no one-size-fits-all solution, and I also don't believe that we've reached the end of the list of the types of reuse that are out there. So every site is different, and we just have to make sure that the reuse type that's selected is most appropriate. So let me get started with the slide number seven, which is an example of commercial reuse. This is the Tinkham Garage site in Londonderry, New Hampshire, and it used to be a former waste disposal site where liquids and sludge from septic tank truck washing, that's a mouthful, were deposited on the ground surface directly behind the garage. There are a lot of reuse discussions in the early stages of remediation. Users had a number of misconceptions and questions about reuse possibilities. So EPA provided stakeholders with clear information that allowed them to make informed decisions. And now, in the community of, in the city of Londonderry, there's a Home Depot, there's a Staples, there's a 99 restaurant, which is a popular chain in New England, and a Dunkin' Donuts. This is the reuse example where we say it's a really great example of reuse, but we're not sure it's a victory for public health. Anyway, we also have a new senior housing complex, which has 125 units. The town of Londonderry has a higher tax revenue and greater economic activity as a result of the reuse. And Londonderry's improved their traffic patterns due to transportation infrastructure improvements. We've also seen that property values around the site in both in Londonderry have risen to the satisfaction of surrounding residents. Go on to the next slide. This is an example of public service reuse. There's a medical center, a transit station, and a large retail store. So to facilitate reuse, which began in 1996, EPA worked with a group of people interested in reusing the site, and the partnership that they developed allowed for reuse to be integrated with remedial planning efforts. So today, a portion of the property is a station for the Utah Transit Authority's Transit Express, which is a two-line light rail system that provides easier access to Salt Lake City. There's a retail membership warehouse club, and there's the Intermountain Medical Center. And the hospital serves as the main referral for several surrounding states and healthcare institutions. Next slide, page 9, please. Industrial reuse is another type of reuse. This is a Solatron microwave Superfund site in Port Salerno, Florida. This was a film resistor and connector plating and manufacturing business. And EPA provided information to facilitate the site's reuse by working with local officials and prospective purchasers. So today, and in response to concerns that people had about the site's stigma and potential liability issues, EPA issued a comfort letter and entered into a prospective purchaser agreement with the Port Salerno Industrial Park, who's the site's owner. So the company's redeveloping the site as an industrial park for warehouse, office, and commercial retail land uses. 6 acres of the site are reserved for wetland areas, and there's an upland preserve for native plant habitat and a 50-foot natural buffer between the site and surrounding residential areas. And there's a surface water retention basin for stormwater management. So the industrial park has been constructed, and 3 of the 7 lots have been sold. And this is actually a site where the owners were awarded our Excellence in Reuse Award by Region 4 for their willingness to coordinate development efforts beyond on a site with EPA cleanup activities. So let me move on to the next slide that we call mixed reuse, Midvale Slag. So this is a former smelter site, and the outcome of this cleanup is really striking. It's approximately 800 jobs. It's almost $2 million in annual property tax revenue and a $145 million increase in the value of the property. Families have moved into new condos with more than 2,500 residential units are planned. Office buildings, a supermarket have been built. There's commercial office and retail space. And there's going to be a Utah Transit Authority light rail station, or it's been completed. Let me try to move a little faster here on slide 11 is an example of recreational reuse. And I hope what you're taking from this is that there are several different ways that a property can be reused. The Auburn Road landfill, again in Londonderry, New Hampshire, was actually remediated. It was complete and it remained vacant, but there was very little interest in it until we were approached by the Academy of Model Aeronautics. They had a local chapter called the New Hampshire Flying Tigers, and they noticed the vacant land, and they approached EPA and the town about the possibility of using a small portion of the site as a model airplane flying field. The town officials are pleased that the site's reuse is managed by responsible stewards who are helping to deter trespassing, vandalism, and vagrancy, and the Flying Tigers are enjoying a much-needed field in a convenient location. And another really important example is alternative energy reuse, and we have pictures here of the Aerojet General Corporation. This site covers $6,000 near Rancho Cordova, California, which is east of Sacramento. The Aerojet General continues to operate there, but what we've done is they built a 6-megawatt solar plant on 40 acres of the property, and Aerojet collaborated with Solar Power Inc. on this. So it's the largest single-site industrial project of its kind in the United States. And the plant supplies energy to power the site's remediation, and it's fed into the local grid. And we also, next page, we also have what we call ecological reuse. And the Calumet container site is a great example. It's located between two lakes and includes several wetland areas. And ecological restoration and wetland mitigation were important goals. So once complete, the site will be restored as a native habitat area, and it could also provide a recreational resource for the community, including local and regional recreational areas and trail networks. And last but not least, on the next page, I just want to spend a minute talking about agricultural reuse. This is the 100-acre Rose Township Superfund site in Rose Township in Michigan. It's a great example of agricultural reuse, and we are going to talk, Michelle's going to talk about it later today. But I think this is a nice segue into urban gardening. So let me go to slide 15 and then slide 16. Okay, great. So as you can see from what I've been talking about, we're seeing a wide range of activities, for reuse activities, and we're also seeing a wide range of agricultural activities taking place on Superfund sites. And these include traditional farming, grazing, ranching, sustainable forestry, waste recycling, and alternative energy production, and even agricultural research and community food systems and urban gardening projects. And next slide. And examples of all these types of agricultural activities are discussed in detail in what we call a white paper that SRI has recently posted on its website. And this report provides a series of case studies that looks at how Superfund sites can provide needed land for various agricultural enterprises. It also provides tools and references for finding out more information about agricultural reuse on Superfund sites. So in the next couple of slides, I just want to share some information from this white paper that's relevant to our discussion today. So next slide. So this report establishes a definition of urban gardening in the context that it's part of the growing community food system movement. And in a community food system, food production, processing, distribution, and consumption are integrated to enhance public and environmental health. And USDA reported that the number of farmers markets climbed from, there was over 6,000 in 2010, and it's up 53% from a decade earlier. And they're estimating that sales from those markets reached $1 billion in the year 2000, by contrast. 400 farms offer direct farmer-to-consumer community-supported agriculture programs, and in 2011, there are approximately 1,500 programs nationwide. So moving on to slide 19. So urban Superfund sites are often located in close proximity to large numbers of people, as well as lower-income neighborhoods with limited access to fresh produce. And these sites are large enough that they can support viable urban farms and available infrastructure that there can reduce the startup cost. And in addition, the revitalization of these formerly vacant, stigmatized properties can help foster and sustain neighborhood revitalization efforts, replacing areas of community concern with what we call local amenities. Next. So I hope by now I've gotten us all on the same page about Superfund reuse and urban gardening in particular. We're going to just turn the discussion toward tools and resources that are available to help determine whether urban gardening is a viable option, and if so, how to move forward with your project. So, Michelle, I'd like to turn things over to you now to start us off talking about tools and resources.
Great. Thank you, Melissa. Let everyone know I'm going to start on slide 21. And essentially, I'm going to talk to you today about growing gardens in urban soils, particularly in on sites where you think they might have some potential contamination. As we move to slide 22, a lot of the information that I'm going to share with you is in a publication that EPA put out last year entitled "Reusing Potentially Contaminated Landscapes: Growing Gardens in Urban Soils." And I'm also going to share with you information and resources where you can go for more information. So if we go to the next slide, slide 23. This is the cover of the publication that I mentioned. EPA, we decided to do this publication because we were getting so many questions about different contaminants. How do I know if my site is contaminated? What's the exposure? And we thought it would be really good in a publication like this to educate people about soils and plants, and, you know, and how they play a role in the whole urban gardening and potentially contaminated landscaping picture. And we really wanted to help communities understand what they can do to ensure it's safe for them to garden in soils that may be contaminated. And I'll also mention, as you see on the slide, that it is also available in Spanish translation. And I'll give you links to where to find all this information later in this presentation. So on slide 24, soil nutrients are vital for healthy soil, and they have to be available for plants to grow. And we stress the importance of soil tests because they will help you determine your existing nutrients available in your soil, indicate which nutrients and nutrient amounts need to be added. Soil nutrients may be added in various forms. You can use fertilizer, lime, organic matter that includes things like grass clippings, leaves, and compost. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more in the presentation. And also, the soil physical properties help you determine how well the nutrients are available to plants. And there's ways that you can improve the physical quality of your soil, but you can by leveling it or loosening the soil, adding organic matter such as compost and manure. And also, soil pH can affect the amount and types of nutrients available to plants through their roots. As most of you probably know, the pH scale goes from 0 to 14, the lower number being more acidic, a higher number being more basic or alkaline. And the important thing about soil pH is certain nutrients are less available to plants and soils where the pH is too low or too high. So that also brings us back to the whole soil testing idea and getting to find out what the pH of your soil is. And then also based on this information, you'll be able to determine while different soil additions or soil amendments are needed to change the pH of your soil to meet your gardening needs. So if we move to the next slide, here's a table that lists different sources of contamination that we commonly find on sites with a commercial or industrial history. And basically, a soil contaminant is an element or chemical present in the soil at a level that could possibly pose health risk. And it's important to know that in a few areas of the country, element levels may be naturally high, and in many cases, human activities have increased the soil's level of many elements and chemicals, and has also spread them out more widely. So lead, cadmium, arsenic, zinc, PAHs are commonly found in an urban environment. In addition, other contaminants can also be found in areas near former commercial or industrial properties. Soils also contain background levels of some of these elements, these are basically the naturally occurring levels of elements and chemicals found in any soil. And they differ depending on the region of the country in which you live. And USGS has actually published information on soil background levels in the United States. You can find that on their website. So on slide 26, an exposure pathway is the way in which a contaminant comes into contact with people. If your site assessment concludes that contaminants are present, the next step is to think about potential ways that people are going to come in contact with that contaminated soil if they use it to garden or eat the food that they're growing. There are essentially two human exposure pathways to soil contaminants. There's the soil-to-human pathway and the soil-to-plant-to-human pathway. So the soil-to-human exposure pathway, while gardening, the greatest risk of exposure to contaminants is from contaminated soil getting into your mouth or by breathing in contaminated dust. For example, children playing in the garden may directly eat the soil through hand-to-mouth play, or people may eat plants without first washing them, and they might still have soil or dust adhering to that plant that they're eating. Skin contact or dermal exposure with soil containing contaminants like PAHs, chromium, TCE can also pose health risks. So for the soil to plant to human exposure pathway, it is true that some edible plants do take up and accumulate contaminants. A plant's uptake of a contaminant depends on many factors though, including the type of plant, pH of the soil, the organic matter content of the soil. So to reduce concerns of exposure from eating plants, you want to make sure you wash your produce thoroughly before eating to remove any potential soil contamination. And keep in mind that root vegetables may have a higher potential for accumulating contaminants. In some cases, it may just be prudent to avoid growing edible plants in soils with high contaminant concentrations. So on slide 27, here are just some recommendations and best practices that can decrease the likelihood of exposure to contaminants that are commonly found in urban soils located on sites that might have some sort of past industrial or commercial use. I'm going to talk a little bit more in detail about phytotechnologies, soil amendments, and best practices in the forthcoming slides. So let's move to slide 28. So here is a table of different types of phytotechnologies, and which are basically a set of techniques that make use of plants to achieve environmental goals. These techniques use plants to extract, degrade, contain, or immobilize pollutants in the soil, groundwater, surface water, or other contaminated media. Phytotechnologies remediate contaminants using several different mechanisms dependent on the application, and these are the mechanisms within this table that you can read through. I'm going to show you where you can find this. It's in an actual EPA publication. So let's move to the next slide, slide 29. This is another table from the same publication that I'm going to share with you the link. It's a phytotechnology matrix that lists the mechanisms, applications, and levels of testing for contaminants that phytotechnologies have effectively removed or controlled. So we found this information published in the scientific literature. The one thing I want to point out is you'll notice not every single contaminant is listed on this table because this table is just talking about cases in which there has been some success using phytotechnologies for that contaminant cleanup. And one of the things I want to point out in particular is something that's not on the list is lead. And this is because phytoremediation of lead in soils is pretty much ineffective since lead is generally not available for plant uptake. It just stays in the soil. So on slide 30, here I have shared two pieces of information with you and a couple websites. The photo on the left is a picture of a phytotechnology project profiles that EPA maintains on our CLUIN webpage where you can search through what phytotechnologies we've found either from our experience or in the literature has worked, and you can search by contaminant, by state, by region, EPA region. And there's a number of other options for searching this database, so I want to make sure all of you are aware of that. So if there's a contaminant in particular you're looking to see if it'll phytotechnologies will work, you can look in this database and see if someone else has done the same thing. And the publication to the right is where I pulled the table from the previous two slides. It basically talks about phytotechnologies for site cleanup and goes into a lot more specifics about all the different contaminants. What we know about how you could use phytotechnologies for remediation of those. So I would encourage you to go to these websites. So on this slide, this is also in our Urban Gardening publication. These are some best practices for you in the garden. You know, you want to make sure that you're not putting your garden right up to a building that could have lead paint that was on there and it's going to flake into your garden. Using organic matter compost and mulch, putting landscape fabric down between the soil and any new soil that you're putting down. You want to make sure that if you are having your children in the garden with you, that they're not, you know, you keep an eye on them, that they're not actually ingesting soil. You want to always wear gloves to protect your hands from the soil. And when you're if you're growing things like greens, you might want to throw away the outer leaves of the plants before washing them, because soil particles can stick to that part of the plant. Washing your produce using, you know, general basic kitchen practices is highly recommended. And you also want to make sure that you're not tracking the soil into your house. You want to clean your tools after you use them. You know, maybe change your clothes before you walk all around your house, take your shoes off, and then peeling your root vegetables that might have been in direct contact with the soil is something else that we recommend. Okay, so on slide 32, this is our website on Clue-In that focuses specifically on growing gardens in urban soils, and you'll find a link to the publications that I've showed you. And you'll see that we put a series of questions on the bar that on the sidebar there that you'll be able to click on. So this is a website where you can find a lot of the information in which I've just presented to you. So on slide 33, this is EPA's brownfields resources and related links, and it'll take you to a lot of different sources of information. But I think the one thing I wanted to point out that you will be able to find information on funding opportunities for gardening and agriculture on potentially contaminated properties, and I know that's a question that a lot of our presenters that you'll hear from today, we always get that question. So I wanted to make sure that you knew of this webpage. So on slide 34, these are some of the publications that have been put out by the Brownfields program. And I want to point to the two publications on the left. We're going to hear from Stephanie Swick and Chris Choi from Region 5, who led the development of these publications. But I just want to say that, you know, there's lots of ways to reduce or eliminate your risk from gardening on potentially contaminated land. And gardening provides many benefits to communities and individuals. And I hope that you will visit these fact sheets and information and tools, you know, to help your community create a healthy garden and growing a variety of delicious and nutritious crops.
Okay. Thanks, Michelle. You want to do those questions?
Yeah, there's a couple questions that came in. I guess I can take a look at it. And the first one that we got, I think maybe Mark Mataloni might be able to help us with this, and maybe even Chris and Stephanie, but do tomato plants take up arsenic to levels of concern located by old railroad ties? I don't think EPA would recommend using old railroad ties to build raised beds or anything like that. And as far as the research, I think I will defer to Mark Mataloni. He's our toxicologist risk assessor that's going to call in. So we can ask that question again. And the next question we got, to what depth does EPA recommend clean soil to be added to a site with potential soil contamination prior to gardening? This is another question. I think I'll hold off on this question until Mark Mataloni gets it on, and we can maybe have a discussion then.
I think that Mark is the third question.
Yeah, we have a risk assessor who's going to be on that I think will be able to help us with these questions that were coming in. So why don't we move into Stephanie's presentation, and then we, you know, when Mark is on, we'll have a larger Q&A session.
That sounds great, Michelle. Let's turn it over to Stephanie Swick. She's going to be talking to us about the interim guidelines for safe gardening on brownfield sites. So, Stephanie?
Hi, thanks for having me on the webinar. As Michelle said, my name is Stephanie Swick, and I work in Region 5's Office of Community and Land Revitalization in Chicago. And like Michelle, we found we were getting a number of inquiries from communities about how best to reuse previously or potentially contaminated land for agricultural purposes, and we felt that we should begin to better understand the issue, and that's why we're here today. So if you go to slide 36, why urban agriculture? As has been mentioned earlier on today's webinar, reusing contaminated land for agriculture has many benefits. The removal of blight or greening vacant properties, improving neighborhood access to food, food safety, improving children's health, potentially creating a few jobs. These are all ways that urban ag can revitalize the neighborhood or the area around a contaminated site. So the question we kept getting was, how do we implement urban ag on a brownfield site safely? Slide 37. How do we get started? Well, Cleveland approached us for some targeted brownfield assessment funds, and we helped them test soil in urban sites at 70 potential community garden sites in cooperation with the city, Neighborhood Progress, and the Ag Extension Service at The Ohio State University. Then we built a committee of experts from diverse backgrounds, such as academia, city staff, multiple EPA offices, consultants, farmers, USDA, policymakers, and researchers, and we all recognize the need to get everybody on the same page. So we put together two webinars, the State of Scientific Knowledge and Research Needs, which includes contaminant exposure routes, bioavailability, and plant uptake, and policy barriers and incentives to reusing brownfields for community gardens and urban agriculture. This included stability of land tenure and the lack of clear cleanup standards. Both of these are recorded, and they're up on the headquarters brownfields urban ag site there. And then we found that the question is really twofold. How clean is clean for people to farm in, and what is the risk to people, particularly children, when farming in soil on former brownfield sites? And then how clean is clean for crops to grow in? What is the likelihood that contaminants will be taken up into the edible portions of plants? So this is an issue now for cities trying to redevelop vacant properties for food safety, for food access, children's health, stormwater management, etc. And to reconcile this problem, we organized a working session with 60 invited experts to discuss various scenarios for urban ag redevelopment, and the result is this guidance. So if you go to the next slide, 38, the guidelines are organized by this logic model seen on the right. First, we identify our previous uses and determine if they were high or low risk. Since this is a Superfund reuse webinar, I think we can go ahead and assume that a significant portion of the site would have a high-risk use. But in each case, we give some examples of the types of contaminants you might expect to see at the sites that house these kinds of uses. Slide 39. Then we perform sampling. So in each case, we recommend that a basic set of samples taken. You want to find out the suitability of the existing soils as a soil medium, which includes testing for nutrients and organic content, etc. And then you would collect samples based on the previous uses identified in the previous step, basing your sampling frequency on the level of risk that they analyze the test for on the suspected contaminants present. So next slide. The next step is to interpret your results, something that is often overlooked. It's important to work with your state regulatory agency to determine what levels are considered safe in your area and for the type of gardening you'll be performing. Next, we potentially have performed site cleanup. So once again, if we assume this is a former Superfund site, the step may be moot, but it's important to know what exactly you're dealing with as far as soil conditions prior to gardening. Slide 41. Anytime you garden in an urban area, regardless of previous use, it makes sense to implement best management practices. So I won't go into this in detail because Michelle covered a lot of this, except to say that a combination of building physical controls and keeping up your good habits minimizes risk by removing potential exposure routes. So now you can begin farming. Next slide. So, although, take a step back here. So we got to go ahead to begin farming on the previous slide. It's important to add that you're not quite finished with your garden planning. Most successful urban ag projects of any size follow some kind of business plan, which is modified throughout the process I've described, to include changing assumptions regarding the type of gardening or crops you want to grow based on the existing conditions at your site. For example, a site that meets some but not all the state standards for agriculture uses may want to skip straight to raised beds, which would increase the cost for fill, or move to an orchard instead of green-based crops, which might have implications on your clients or your time frames for production. Since we have Chris Choi speaking next, I will leave him to describe the benefits of this type of planning and move on to the next slide, 43. Wow, I really powered through these slides. So there you have it. That's the basics of the Urban Ag Guidance, which is available online, as Michelle said, can be downloaded from the epa.gov/brownfields/urban-ag. But since completing the guidance, we've continued working with communities such as those involved in the HUD-DOT-EPA Partnership for Sustainable Communities on Ag Issues. And an example there is the Kansas State and EPA composting study, which is now in its second season in Indianapolis. Another example of this work that Chris will talk about is the Toledo Urban Farm Business Plan Handbook. We just wrapped up working with our EJ Showcase community in Milwaukee on an urban agriculture code audit, and that will be published soon. And EPA is also working with the Association of State and Territorial Solid Waste Management Officials, or ATSWAMO, on an urban agricultural toolbox, which could be modified by each state to communicate the urban ag policies and approaches. And that is expected this summer. That will also be linked on the Urban Ag webpage. So finally, I can't talk about a brownfields product without saying that we can definitely use brownfields assessment funds to help communities assess sites for urban agriculture reuses. And we're seeing more of these types of projects proposed in our annual competitions each year. So that concludes my talk. I really did go fast.
Thank you, Stephanie. No problem at all. That just gives people more time for questions at the end. Why don't we go ahead and turn it over to Chris Choi, who's also from Region 5. And Chris is going to be speaking to us about developing a business plan for urban farms.
Great. Thank you. And we're on slide 44 for those of you who are following. And I want to step back a little bit just because, before you actually begin gardening, one of the most important things that you can do is really looking at developing a business plan, and I'll show you why this is the case. Let's turn to the next slide, please. And I want to begin sort of where our project started. Our project started actually in Toledo, Ohio, and for those of you who are not familiar with where Toledo is in northwest Ohio. And the site that we worked at, called Fernwood, actually, is about 2.5 miles northwest of downtown. And, this is one area that's pretty typical of many sort of inner urban city areas where you'll see lots of former industrial manufacturing, which is now no longer there. There's lots of vacant lots. A lot of things that really are not going too well in this area. And as I sort of described on the right, it was a former Champion Spark Plug factory. It's about 2 acres large, next to train tracks. It's been vacant for 16 years. There hasn't been a lot of activity. But also, couple that with some of the statistics coming out of Toledo, it's the 8th poorest city in the nation, where 24% of the residents live below the poverty level, unemployment rate from 12 to 15%. 70% of the residents are either overweight or obese. Healthy food access is a big issue. And amidst all this, there's all this vacant land. And so a lot of these communities are sort of seeing urban ag as a reuse possibility for basically places that really have little use right now. And so the thing that sort of to keep in mind is the organization that's been doing this, they have a lot of really good intentions, but at the same time, they're not farmers. And I would imagine for most people who are embarking on urban ag, they're mostly nonprofit organizations that really have a lot of good intentions but aren't farmers. Next slide, please. And so, as part of the Farm and Growing Center, there were goals that they wanted to hit for this particular piece of land. They wanted to provide healthy food. They wanted to change the lifestyles of the residents in the area. They thought about it as an opportunity, really, to help maybe with the local economy and provide jobs. And also an opportunity maybe to get rid of some of the vacant properties in the brownfield sites in the area and turn them into something that's productive. There were some key community concerns. You know, the site also, besides sort of being vacant and just sitting there, was a potential threat to public health and safety. You know, vacant lots often attract crime and illegal activities. And then also, you know, the vacant properties created a negative community and neighborhood image and a negative impact to local property values. So in many ways, they sort of see this as an opportunity to improve lots of things within the area. But how do we translate these goals into an operating farm? Slide 47, please. And so, like I mentioned, you know, while their intention is good, they haven't really thought through what the necessary steps were to make this a sustainable and successful garden. And, you know, there were a lot of basic things to consider. We came in initially, part of our technical assistance was to help them design the programming for the site. But I think we quickly learned that there were a lot of questions that they needed to answer. So things like, you know, the type of crop that we grow, you know, who's going to do the work, what's the crops going to be, how will they be sold, you know, what's the startup costs, you know, competitors, how do you address cleanup of the site? All these questions they didn't quite have answers to, but really needed to be answered before you even embark on something like this. Next slide, please. Slide 48. So we had this process, and Toledo actually is very, very fortunate in that they had a really strong urban ag community there, and so there were lots of partners that were willing to help out and pitch in and answer questions and give us the kind of information that will help us answer the questions that I had listed before. And so these are just some of the partners that we had worked with. And through numerous meetings, webinars, interviews, site visits, we helped addressing some of those questions that needed to be answered. And a lot of those questions really started forming the basis of this Urban Ag tool, which I want to describe next. Next slide, please. Slide 49. So I want to talk about sort of the three components of the business plan. The first up is the marketing strategy. And so the market section really provides an analysis of the market to identify your potential customers or target market. So to identify your potential partners, you'll first need to have a general understanding of the environment in which your business will operate. Economic factors such as inflation, unemployment rate, interest rates, and income affect the potential customer's purchasing power and spending patterns. So, you know, who are your customers? Are they individuals, businesses, and where are they located? How large is this customer base? What products will you be growing? Would it be organic products, ethnic products, or specific types of vegetables or even seeds or native plants? And, you know, just keep in mind, a lot of crops are perishable. How will you keep your products, how will you get your products to your customers? You know, is there refrigeration on site? Will products be available year-round or will it be seasonal? How will products be priced? What is the potential sales volume? You know, who's your competition? Grocery stores, specialty food stores, and how will they respond to your market? And how will you market your products and find potential customers? Slide 50, please. Another component of the business plan is the operating strategy. So the operational strategy section goes through the approach for cultivating and harvesting the crops, the estimated production capacity, and the physical resources needed to operate them. You know, how will you maximize the crop that can be produced on-site in order to meet the objectives in your marketing strategy? You know, the amount, you know, type, quality, price. What is the estimated amount of crops that can be repeatedly produced, you know, pounds of produce per month for each market segment and crop type, given the available resources and space? What are the requirements for land, buildings, equipment necessary to produce and market your crops? How would these be acquired? What is the staff requirement to manage and operate the farm? And what are the state and local zoning, permitting, licensing, and regulatory issues that need to be addressed to operate the farm? Next slide, please. Yeah. Finally, we come to the financial strategy. And the financial strategy reviews the financial aspects of the farm, including expenses, projected income, profitability, potential sources of funding, and potential risk to the successful operation of the farm. Expenses include marketing, operating, human resource expenses discussed earlier, as well as administrative and startup expenses. There are also expenses related to site preparation, environmental investigations, and remediation expenses. thinking about sort of the income, what's the five-year projection for annual income for the farm? Income should include receipts from sales, less spoilage or products that cannot be sold, and any income from grants, donations that are occurring and can help cover annual operating expenses. The income and expense section shows the projected annual profit and loss for each year. And then the fixed assets section includes documents that estimate the cost to purchase or install any new land, buildings, motor vehicles, furniture, office equipment, computers, fixtures, and machinery. The funding requirements section describes the sources and amount of capital required to purchase and install the fixed assets needed to start up the farm and achieve the five-year goals of the business plan. And then finally, the risk management section lays out the response to issues such as crop failure, low yields, restrictions on land use, competitive pricing, labor issues, or funding loss. Next slide, please. Slide 52. And I don't want to be a damper about, you know, like putting out all these questions, but these are, you know, if you're thinking about like developing an urban farm, it's essentially a business, and these are all the things that you really need to consider in order to have it be successful. So tying it all together, and this is sort of backwards when you sort of think about it, but once you've developed your marketing strategy, your operation strategy, your financial strategy, you're actually then prepared to write, you know, what your vision statement is, what your mission statement is, and what your goals are going to be. And the marketing, operation, and financial strategy explains how the farm will fulfill the vision, mission, and goals. The introduction, which is completed at the end, will summarize this information to potential readers of the business plan. Slide 53, please. And so, you know, besides sort of like getting all your ducks in a row and everything in lined up, the potential uses of the business plan is actually to help you think about these issues, but then also to help you communicate these plans that you have to potential stakeholders. And so, you know, if you're thinking about like, you know, how you're going to bring in people to work at the farm or investors to provide funding for you, the business plan tool is really a useful way to do that. And next slide, please. Slide 54. And so you're able to download, again, over at the Brownfields Urban Ag site, and the site address is listed on the screen right now. And if you have further questions, you can contact me. That's it.
Thanks, Chris, very much. That was great. We've had a couple of questions come through, so let's see if we can go through some of these. Michelle, you want to take the one about the link?
Yeah, if someone had just asked, they wanted to know what the link was for one of the phytotechnology tables that I presented on slide, particularly on slide 29. Well, if you look on slide 30, the last link, which is a PDF file, will take you to that fact sheet. So you can go back to slide 30 and you'll find the link to that.
Okay, thanks. And then we have a question I think Stephanie could answer. Let's see, the questioner says, you mentioned that after assessment we should proceed with soil cleanup. What exactly does that mean, and how do we decide what to do? Soil removal, on-site amendment, cover and build raised beds. Stephanie, can you give that one a try?
Sure. That's really what I was talking about in the amorphous interpret results category. The state is going to help you figure out what levels they consider safe for the use that you're proposing. So that will determine whether or not, you know, if it's going to be in a residential area, if it's going to be a community garden, you probably want to meet residential soil levels for cleanup. And depending on what you have there, that might mean you have to dig and haul. But if you work with them, they could also give you guidance on, well, how much fill can you just put on top and build a raised bed and have it still be considered safe. So depending on the amount of contamination present, there are a lot of different options. And as the questioner asked, it really depends on exactly how much is there.
Okay, thanks, Stephanie. Now we've got one, I think Michelle's going to take on land break policies.
Yeah, we got a question or more of a statement saying, talking about land grant universities, and that each state has been testing, soil testing, including contaminants, and making soil treatment fertilizer recommendations for years. And this person is just suggesting that EPA partner with land-grant universities, which has soil quality testing in place, an extension service, and then mentions that both Toledo and Cleveland are in Ohio. Why not partner with Ohio State? It makes other suggestions similar to that, and then asks specifically, how do you see EPA partnering with the local land-grant universities on these sites? And I'll just say, I mean, we partner with a lot of different entities, and we're always looking for more opportunities, so I appreciate the suggestion. And we, for example, I have an interagency agreement with Rufus Cheney with USDA. I know that's not a land-grant university, but it is, you know, our way of getting the experts who know this topic well working on these sites and these projects. And we've also have collaborated with universities such as Ohio State University, and the University of Washington, Kansas State, University of Arizona, et cetera. So we're always willing and able to figure out how we can create more partnerships. So thank you for the suggestion. And I don't know if Chris or Stephanie want to add anything to that.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. Just to let you know, we did work very closely with Ohio Ag Extension, Ohio State Ag Extension, on the Cleveland Targeted Brownfield Assessment that I talked about at the beginning of my talk. And then if you flip through the guidance, it gives you a link on how to get to all the different Ag Extension offices in your area. Because we really do depend on them to work with the public.
Definitely.
Okay, thanks. Why don't we turn it, Michelle, back over to you. Michelle's going to be speaking about several sites that are being used for various types of urban gardening projects.
Sure. So if everyone could make sure you're on slide 56. I am going to talk about some properties that we know about that have been affected by contamination and now have some sort of successful garden or agricultural project now going on. I just want to point out, I'm not the EPA expert on these sites, but I did, as part of this presentation, we did want to present you with some examples and the different types of urban gardening, from small residential gardens to farms, farmers markets, and hope that these examples might help you in drawing parallels to a property near you. If you think you'd be interested in learning more specifics about these sites that I will present to you in the next slides, I encourage you to fill out the evaluation form at the end of the presentation and let us know so we can consider that as a topic for a future webinar. So if you move to slide 57, this is a photo of an American Street Tannery. It used to be an old industrial lot called the American Street Tannery. As you can see, the area has been transformed into a thriving urban garden. This site is one of several tanneries that operated on one city block within the Northern Liberties neighborhood in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, sold out in 1986. And the backstory on this site is the facility operations led to the area's contamination with pesticides, PCBs, and metals. And essentially, EPA conducted removal actions and cleaned up the site, and now it's being used for this garden for the community. So if we move to slide 58, here you see a picture of fruits and vegetables that have been sold at the Greensgrove Farm, which is on the Boyle Galvanizing property. This site is located on a one-acre plot in Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood. The site had been used to house a former steel galvanizing factory, which after closing had left the area vacant and contaminated, causing lead, arsenic, zinc, and cadmium contamination in the soil. EPA went and conducted a removal action at the site in 1985 to address these contaminants, evacuating the contaminated soil and backfilling the site with clean soil. Slide 59, you'll see another picture of this site. This is with their first scheduled pickup for community-supported agriculture. So the founder of Greensgrove, Mary Seton Corboy, she was basically looking to start an urban farm to grow lettuce that she could supply to restaurants in Philadelphia. And she selected this site because it was a large piece of property that was located close to her customers. And in order to ensure the feasibility of the site's agricultural reuse, she relied on EPA's risk assessment and coordinated with environmental specialists at Penn State University. Greensboro Farm trucked in additional clean soil, constructed greenhouses, and grows crops hydroponically, and later has built some raised beds on the site. Now we're on slide 60. Melissa has mentioned this site briefly in her presentation. Here you see some sprinklers watering the crops that are being grown for research at the Rose Township site, which is located in Rose Township, Michigan. The backstory on this site is that it was a 110-acre site used for unauthorized disposal of paint sludges and volatile organic compounds, which basically happened between 1966 until 1968, and then a little bit in 1970. So from 1979 to 1980, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality removed 5,055 gallon drums of waste from the site, and then EPA fenced off portions of the site, removed an additional 31 drums of waste plus 20 cubic yards of soil. Some of the other cleanup activities included treating the PCB-bearing surface soils with a mobile incinerator at the site. They constructed and operated an interim groundwater pump and treat system to contain the groundwater plume during the incineration, installed soil vapor extraction unit, and essentially all of these cleanup activities concluded in February of 1996. So if we move to slide 61, here you'll see pictures of the farms that are at the Rose Township site. So after the cleanup, Daimler Chrysler, who was one of the primary responsible parties, began to explore agricultural reuse at the site. And basically they were interested in using a 2-acre portion of the property as an experimental site for the development of alternative fuels. As a result, 2 acres of the site were seeded in 2006 with soybeans, sunflowers, corn, canola, and switchgrass. And each year the harvest is tested for its potential of these crops to be refined into renewable fuels such as ethanol and biodiesel. And so far, the results have indicated that the biomass produced is of comparable quantity and quality to biomass generated from crops grown on conventional farmland. I do want to point out it's important to know that the crops grown on this site are not used for human consumption. So here you see a picture of some outreach material. It's a part of a poster for EPA's cleanup method employed at the South Prescott neighborhood cleanup. This is in West Oakland, California. We're on slide 62 now. EPA essentially performed a removal assessment at this site in the fall of 2009 to address the industrial contamination in residential soils. At the time, several community members came forward to inquire about the plan work and how it might impact public health. There's a high incidence of asthma in this community. Citizens were concerned about dust generated from typical removal actions and how this would impact their health. And this is also an area with limited grocery and food store options. So the community kind of wanted to make sure that the cleanup would allow them to safely grow their own produce in their yards. So taking these concerns into consideration, EPA developed a plan to safely treat the contamination without excavation and without removal. They used locally trained workers to clear vegetation and debris from the soil, and then tilled in calcium phosphate, which is derived from fishbone meal. And essentially, the calcium phosphate binds up with the lead in the soil, forming a stable, non-toxic mineral compound that's called pyromorphite. And then they put a clean soil cover over the treated area, and appropriate plantings are established to prevent erosion and also serve as an additional barrier to the bound lead below the surface. So if we move to slide 63, this is just another picture of the South Prescott neighborhood in West Oakland, PA. This is actually a community center or a command post that EPA has where the community come to meet and ask questions, just a nice gathering place. And you'll see in these big white tubs in the back of the picture, there's some bamboo plantings there. They're not planted in the ground. As we all know, bamboo is pretty invasive, but beyond the bamboo is actually the AMCO Superfund site and also a highway. And what they're doing in this community is they're planting these planters of bamboo to kind of keep the noise and the dust and things down, or at least so it doesn't come through the bamboo, because we all know how thick bamboo can grow. So that was a pretty interesting thing that they're doing there. Provide some screening, too. So on slide 64, this is a photograph of the Humboldt smelter from July 2009. That's on the left. And then on the right is a photo of the area around the Iron King Humboldt smelter, including residences. This site is located in Dewey Humboldt in Arizona. The site has been contaminated as a result of releases from two operations, the Iron King mine and the Humboldt smelter. And the contaminants at this site, basically due to past mining and smelting operations, arsenic, lead, other metals contaminating the soil, sediment, surface, and groundwater on the site. So if we move to the next slide, which is slide 65, here you see pictured a map outlining the future use scenarios at the site. And this is basically featured in the 2010 reuse assessment for this site. And also at this site, EPA designed a handout about arsenic-contaminated soils for residents that live near the site in order to provide the residents with good health practice tips for the home, lawn, garden work, and play. And the practices outlined in this pamphlet help residents continue to garden, use their soil safely until it can be cleaned up. And the residents were also encouraged to take precautions such as washing their homegrown vegetables and working to maintain proper levels of nutrients in their soils. There's also exciting local community initiatives in this town to promote safe gardening in the area. There's a local organization called Garden Roots, and they've adopted an initiative called the Dewey Humboldt Arizona Garden Project, which essentially encourages the local community members to collect soil, water, and vegetable samples from their garden for analysis to determine the levels of metals in their homegrown vegetables. And over time, the group hopes that these efforts will enable scientists and community members to improve their scientific understanding of soil and vegetable quality in the area. And I'll mention this project has been done in collaboration with the University of Arizona, and I think it was just last week there was a Clue-In webinar internet seminar on this very topic given by the researcher at the University of Arizona, so I would encourage you to maybe check out the archive of that. So the next slide, slide 66, here you see pictured a golf course on the Southside Sanitary Landfill site, which is located in Indianapolis, Indiana. Soils and groundwater at this site were contaminated with heavy metals, including arsenic, chromium, cadmium, nickel, PAHs. And if we go to the next slide, slide 67, this is inside one of the greenhouses on the site. This is what's going on there now. In addition to continuing to operate a municipal solid waste landfill, this 312-acre former Superfund site in Indianapolis now supports a variety of new land reuses, including methane gas production for multiple local businesses, and a golf course, and an outdoor education center. Since 1989, these greenhouses, which are called Crossroads Greenhouses, is one of the largest methane-powered greenhouses in the United States, and has pulled more than 2.2 million cubic feet of methane gas each day from the landfill. And all of the energy used in the 6.5-acre greenhouse is extracted from the decomposing waste in the adjacent landfill. They grow more than 400,000 poinsettias, bedding plants, hanging baskets, and they're grown and supplied from the greenhouse each year. Excuse me. Here you see a picture of an elevated water garden on the left, and it's basically part of a rainwater harvesting system in this garden. And then to the right, you see a gated entry, brick walkway, raised beds, small trees and flowers blooming on the site, and this is all at the Bridge Plaza Community Garden, which is located in downtown Brooklyn, New York. While this property may or may not have a contaminated past, the urban garden features mostly raised plant beds and stone walkways, which could potentially assist in combating potential contaminants. And it's a great example of how urban green space is acting as a catalyst for community involvement and education. So we're right at a little after 3. I just want to check in real quick because Mark Mataloni was calling in after 3. Mark, have you joined us?
Okay, let me take
it. Yeah, we can take some questions while we wait for Mark.
Okay.
So let's see what came in.
Okay.
Well, here's one. The questioner is asking us to talk more about state involvement. You mentioned the ASUAMO toolbox for states in development. How many states and which ones have had agricultural guidelines for cleanup levels? Are states generally recommending residential levels or stricter for community gardening? I don't know. Stephanie, do you want to take that question?
Sure. What we found is many states are thinking about it, but it's a really tricky subject, you know. So they've all had to go back to the drawing board on what risk levels they think are safe for gardening, especially given the fact that some plants do uptake some contaminants. So that is the whole reason for this ASUAMO's toolbox, because it's basically a template that each state can modify to reflect what they would like their residents to follow. I don't know if any state in particular has a whole complete set of ag guidelines, although I know that Ohio, for example, is pretty far on the spectrum for this. I know that some states have recreational use category, which they consider very similar to something they would have for agriculture. It just really depends on the state and how they want to deal with it. So not exactly a great answer to your question,
right,
but hopefully it helps.
Well, yeah, and I, you know, in doing the research, you know, and Stephanie, we've talked about this, is there isn't a lot of, the guidance is kind of all over the place. And,
yeah.
You know, people are picking numbers, but not really having a lot of reasons why they're picking numbers. I know there's a lot of folks, you know, using EPA soil screening levels, which were developed for the residential standards, but, you know, it's important for folks to know that that doesn't necessarily include the urban gardening exposure pathway. I mean, it really depends on who's going to be using the site, how you're going to be using the site. Because if you're doing an, you know, a large-scale urban ag project and you're not going to have children there, then your exposure pathways might be a little different.
Yeah, I think in as much as you can say generally, many states are saying if you can meet residential, you can do whatever you want on it.
Right.
But they like to, they still like to be involved in that process.
Right. Okay. Has Mark Mataloni had a chance to join in yet?
You know, I just did, Michelle. It sounds like
good.
I came in right at the right time here, too.
You have. We have a number of questions lining up for you, Mark.
Okay. I mean, I don't know if I'm ready to go, but what you're describing almost sounds like a great segue into, you know.
Okay. Well, then great. Then why don't you take it over, and then we'll get back to the questions after you're done talking. So
sure.
I think
okay,
we're on.
Slide 70,
I think, is where we are.
Right. And let me just say that welcome, Mark. Mark Mataloni is from Region 2. He's a toxicologist, and he's been investigating potential lead exposure pathways and ways to minimize lead exposure in urban gardening. So take it away, Mark.
Thank you very much. All right, so just moving to my first. I only have 3 slides, so hopefully it won't take too long. But I am chairing a subcommittee of what you see on the first bullet. TRW stands for our Technical Review Work Group for Lead. It's EPA's agency-wide technical group for lead environmental issues. And we are working in collaboration with a lot of colleagues, some states, our sister agency, ATSDR, our own Brownfields program. So we have a lot of input, which is good because we have a difficult challenge here. And we've been And the reason this work group came about is because we've been fielding queries from various programs and contacts about, and from communities that are near Superfund sites and brownfield sites about, what is a safe level of lead and soil to garden in. And I think what really motivated creation of this subgroup from within the TRW, because as I'll get along, we are a very, how should I say, quantitative type of work group. We develop cleanup goals, and we do the numbers. And so, that's why I think it came to us, because we have found that when these communities are coming to us with these questions, they are due to the ready availability of soil sampling for lead, they are often coming equipped with their soil lead results in hand. And I have 300 parts per million. I have 600 parts per million. So they have specific values, and they want specific answers for in response to the information they're providing. So we our goal, and that's the last bullet on slide 71. Our effort here is to try to come up with some risk-based approach to determine what best management practices for limiting soil exposure would apply at different soil lead concentrations. And you've certainly heard from Michelle and others about all the different management practices. We're just trying to perhaps provide some gradations or tiers to these practices. Now I'll get back to this point, I think, in my third slide. But again, just going through the nuts and bolts of what we were doing, saying, all right, well, if we were going to come up with a risk-based level, if you will, for providing guidance on what levels of lead in soil should be accompanied by certain types of interventions in urban gardening, it should be technically based. So we went about dissecting the lead exposure pathways that would be associated with gardening, and we have identified four primary pathways. And I'll touch on this point later too, but we are the technical review work group for lead. I know that there are a lot of other crap in soil, and that I'm not downplaying it, but we are dealing with lead. I think what holds for lead will hold for a lot of other things, but just know that, and I'll make this point later, for instance, lead generally doesn't go through the skin very well unless you have organic forms, and so we don't really worry about that in an urban gardening situation. But if you had something else like PAHs or some organic compound or pesticides, it certainly could be a concern. But in any event, for lead, we had identified incidental ingestion while gardening. There's some data we have on that. Tracking to the residents contributes to soil derived indoor dust. Unfortunately, there isn't very good empirical data other than just observational data that people realize when they're gardening and they don't take off their shoes, they're tracking in a lot of dirt into their home. But we're struggling right now with trying to quantitate that pathway. Where we actually do have a lot of good data is uptake into homegrown produce. There's a lot of information on how specifically lead, in this case, gets taken up into the vast variety of produce that would typically be home gardened. And then the last exposure pathway is adherence to produce. Not absorption into the matrix of the produce, but just adhesion onto the surface. And as you could certainly imagine, and I'm sure you've probably heard, that this is particularly a problem with root, anything that goes in the ground, and leafy green vegetables, simply because they have just massive surface area, a lot of nooks and crannies. So we've been plowing away through through these pathways and trying to understand as best we can the types, just how much possible lead exposure can occur through each of these. So we have this spreadsheet that's in development right now, and this is literally a work in progress. And as I had mentioned, this spreadsheet is unique to lead, so it doesn't deal with a dermal a pathway, but you certainly could adopt it for other chemicals and add or subtract other things that are appropriate. And in the process, what this spreadsheet is doing is also helping us identify where the data gaps are. Like you said, we just don't have good empirical studies on how much dirt gets tracked back into a house after someone's gardened. We do have some data on how much incidental soil is ingested while gardening, so that's helpful, and we do have decent amount of data on what gets adhered to vegetables, and I already said we have very good data on what gets taken up into produce. So we're making a lot of progress, but we still have a little bit of a ways to go. And just to, I guess, my final slide would be, you know, we're doing this exposure pathway analysis in the hope that it will inform, I think, this delicate and difficult balancing act of weighing beneficial reuse of land and against the need to limit lead exposure. Now, I'm sure any of you that are versed in lead risk assessment are familiar with the very recent, it was just last week, I think, that CDC finalized their recommendations to reduce lead exposure in children. And they made a quantum leap downward from, you know, a level of 10 micrograms per deciliter down to a goal of 5. So now there's even greater impetus or emphasis on trying to get, you know, the less low-hanging fruit, if you will. I mean, we've gotten rid of lead in gas and lead in paint and made some quantum reductions in blood lead levels, but now, you say, you know, we're getting to the law of diminishing returns here. It's getting increasingly difficult to get rid of those last bits of lead. So this, you know, so we know that, and I won't belabor this, I'm sure other people have spoke about it, that there are, you know, many benefits associated with urban gardening. You know, it's healthy food, you're, you know, it's aesthetically pleasing, everyone brags about their tomatoes, and you know, there's economic advantages, you save a few dollars on grocery bill, and you know, more beneficial reuse of land. So, you know, there's a laundry list of benefits here. So we certainly don't want to discourage urban gardening just because there's any lead in the soil. What we're trying to do is trying to find the proper balance between what's a tolerable level of lead and against, you know, the benefits of gardening. And then, again, you know, it's not a static, entity of, well, we're going to have to tolerate this much lead. As we, or as people before me, the speakers before me have noted, there's a whole, you know, toolbox of things you could do to certainly reduce that. So really our objective is to provide the risk-based soil levels that trigger best management practices because, as I'm sure you're aware, some of these practices are certainly not easily implementable. I mean, raised gardens, you know, cost a lot of money, and you need to, you know, get good wood, and people sometimes use, probably create as many hazards as they're avoiding by using some, you know, pressure-treated wood or, you know, any wood that is typically intended for contact with soil has some sort of preservative on it. None of them are good. So, you know, so there's a lot of issues associated with building proper raised beds. But, so that's easy just to say, or use raised beds, but if what we're trying to do is say, well, you know, if you're maybe just at 100 parts per million, you don't really need to do that. You're probably fine with just using good housekeeping, you know, practices, like thorough washing of all the produce and maybe shifting your vegetable selection away from root vegetables, which again tend to take up more lead and adhere more lead, to things like fruiting vegetables, which, you know, are easier to clean and take up less lead. So, you know, so at lower lead levels, maybe that's all you need to do. And as, you know, lead levels steadily increase, then perhaps you need to take, you know, more aggressive actions, like, you know, creating barriers between, you know, topsoil and, or even going entirely to raised beds. And what we found, at least in New York City, is that even raised beds in and of themselves is not an entire panacea, because we have sampled raised beds and found pretty high levels of lead in there, simply from redistribution of community-wide lead problems. So anyway, that's really what we're doing. We're trying to just put a little bit more meat on the bones, and so there's some great guidance. I'm familiar with guidance that Michelle was talking about earlier, and I said it really provides all the necessary information. We're just trying to be perhaps, hopefully, just a little bit more quantitative with it. So when someone does, you know, come with their soil lead level in hand, you could say, all right, well, you know, here's your laundry list of things, and, you know, based on your soil level, perhaps, you know, A, B, and C is sufficient rather than, you know, the entire list. Or, you know, again, maybe just being able to pick and choose what would be appropriate, you know, given the specific soil lead concentration. So I think that's it.
Great. Thank you so much, Mark. I think there's a few questions that lead well into following up on some of the things that you said or trying to clarify things. And we had gotten a question early on about tomato plants and if they take up arsenic to levels of concern if your garden is located by old railroad ties. And, you know, I had made the statement that I don't think EPA would recommend using railroad ties for your raised beds, but we also got a comment in that came in a little bit later because Rufus Cheney is on the line somewhere out there in cyberspace, mm-hmm. and he made the statement that railroad ties are creosol contaminated and it's not arsenic, which would come from CCA. So he stated that only the soil immediately beside the railroad tie would be enriched with benzoapyrene. And then he also stated that avoiding carrots and leafy vegetables will avoid the risk from this contaminant. And I don't know. I think that kind of answers the question, but I don't know if you wanted to say anything about that, Mark.
I would agree. I always agree with my colleague Rufus. He's the authority here. I'm just a.
I agree.
It does allow me to go back and address my last bullet on slide 73, which is something that's of interest right now.
Sorry to interrupt you, Mark, but yeah, I think I know what you're going to go into, because we did get another comment from Rufus asking you to discuss bioavailability of soil lead and lower bioavailability of lead in garden soils that have had long-term use of phosphate fertilizers and compost. So I think that kind of goes hand in hand with your last bullet there. So go ahead.
All right, so, you know, there's enough evidence out there that, you know, adding phosphates to soil, you know, forms these very insoluble lead phosphate mineral complexes, which I'm not a soil scientist, so I'm going to go into a great deal in describing. But, and it's been measured, actually, in leachability tests, less leachability in animal models, and even in human experimentation, where, you know, if you add phosphates to lead-contaminated soil, you get, you know, less leaching and ultimately less absorption. So that's a good thing. But what triggered my thought about the question was the thing about the railroad ties, and Rufus is absolutely right. Railroad ties are treated with creosote, not CCA. You know, so that's the pressure-treated wood that typically used on decks and things like that. You have a creosote or like a pentachlorophenol type of problem, not a, you know, an arsenic one. But the one thing, and we have a couple of research projects in the hopper right now to further investigate this, is that while phosphate certainly works at stabilizing lead in soil, there's much evidence, to indicate that because phosphate and arsenic are pentavalent cations and look a lot alike, that it mobilizes arsenic. So if you have situations where you have that kind of co-contamination, which is not that uncommon, we see it a lot in New York City, and certainly it's could be a problem like in former orchards where they had often used lead arsenate as a growth regulator on crops, that, you know, you have to be careful if you use phosphates, because while you may be reducing the mobility of lead, you may be increasing it of arsenic. So that's certainly a concern of ours.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mark.
We have a questioner who's been very patient, so let me throw this out there. And, Mark, I think you might be the person. The questioner says, to what depth does EPA recommend clean soil be added to a site with potential soil contamination prior to gardening?
Okay, well, that's a good question. Usually, you know, surface cleanups, as a general rule, are usually 1 to 2 feet. When we say, you know, if we have surface contamination, we just don't try to scrape off, you know, a couple of inches. We usually, you know, remediate to about a 1 to 2 foot. And that would probably be a similar guideline for soil, for gardening. Now, I would ask Rufus to chime in on this, but obviously wherever the root system is, you know, extends to is and probably a little beyond is where you, you know, are going to want to limit your contamination.
Okay, thanks,
Mark. Well,
no, there's one other point about that question that Melissa and I were talking about. It also would depend on what your contamination is and what your site-specific problems are, too.
Right.
So we just wanted to make that comment. So go ahead, Melissa.
Okay, great. We've got another question. Let's see. The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality established a risk-based concentration of lead in residential soil at 500 micrograms per
million. Yeah, parts per million.
Yeah, parts per million. On this basis, is there any practical concern to having lead in soil, since most sites would probably be cleaned up to below this concentration?
So I'm not sure I can entirely understand
the
question.
It seems like they're saying that the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality has said that their risk-based concentration for lead is essentially 500 ppm.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to know if there's any practical reason why having yeah, this is a little confusing. I think what they're trying to ask is there any reason why having lead in the soil below this concentration would cause any concern? I think that's what they're asking.
Okay. Well, and
but I could be wrong. It is written a little confusing.
Okay. Could we ask them to unmute and maybe
This person might be streaming online.
Okay.
Most people actually aren't on the phone. So why don't we, if Mark, Mark from Texas, if you're still on the line and you want to clarify, we will try to answer your question. Why don't we do that? And he can write that in, and I'll read it out loud if it comes in. Let's see what else we got here.
I mean, I could, you know, in perhaps the interest of heading off an expansion of the question. If it's how you described it, I think when I first came on, that was part of the question is, you know, all states are, you know, just using residential, you know, cleanup goals. And EPA has their own, right? It's 400, and that's based, you know, that's intended to protect children, you know, and we might be revisiting that because, you know, again, we were targeted 10 micrograms per deciliter, and now, you know, that bar's been lowered. But right now, that 400 was really for a residential exposure scenario where kids incidentally ingesting small amounts of soil every day.
Right.
And that's where we think and soil-derived dust in the indoor environment. So now that's exactly what we're doing with this subcommittee, saying, all right, so 400 is fine for, you know, a kid that's just, you know, going to be having routine contact with this lead-contaminated soil. But what about now a gardening scenario where you're taking in produce, right? You're taking in lead that's taken up into produce and onto produce. So that's two additional exposure pathways. And so that's what we're trying to figure out and to determine if, in fact, you know, while 400 may be, you know, fine just for, you know, for unrestricted use in a home, it might not be fine for unrestricted gardening. I am by no means saying you couldn't garden in 400. I'm just saying you very well may have to start implementing that, you know, list of interventions.
Right. Okay.
We're just suggesting that you might not have to do everything, you know, just a couple of things maybe, you know.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. This question I think maybe is for you and for Stephanie. What material would you suggest for the construction of raised beds?
If you had a fortune, use like cedar or teak.
right.
Yeah. Let me just finish reading the question because maybe they. Would beds made of wood be preferable to ones built with stone or garden block? What about the new extruded plastic lumber or decking material?
Well, I don't know about the decking material, but I think that. You know, if you clean the stone, that would be great. And wood, obviously, is good, as Mark was saying, if you can afford untreated, and then if you can afford cedar, you know, those are two price points. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. Did you want to add anything, Mark?
No, I don't know. I was thinking, we simply don't know what the things like the Trex and all these synthetic materials. I don't know that we just haven't done the studies on things like that, what they might potentially leach into the soil. So, yeah, unless someone else knows, I don't.
We also have a question on materials for the raised beds. And I guess they've asked.
I didn't see that word.
Scroll down a little bit.
We have so many questions we're having.
Oh, here it is. So I guess they're saying if somebody, I think, Mark, you brought up the fact that a raised bed could have raised lead levels. And I guess you want to make the point about where do you get the soil for the raised bed?
I think what we want to just clarify for this questioner is that we're not putting the lead into the raised bed. We're making sure we're using clean soil.
Right. Yeah, it would not help if you just took the soil from your garden and put it and raised it up.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think that kind of answers it. And then we got another comment here about the materials for raised beds. And this is actually Mark Follansbee, who we work closely with the TRW. He made the comment that hemlock also resists rot and is not really expensive. So there's another tip for y'all. Let's see.
And just, you know, again, that's part of the, how should I say, the expense of a raised bed is, building the bed and then having to bring in not a trivial amount of soil that you know is clean.
Okay, we have another question. Mark, I think I'm going to ask you about this one also. Let's see if we've got to find. Okay, here we go. Bioavailability, sort of a long question, so let me read it. Bioavailability can be used to adjust lead risk for soils on Superfund sites. Do you believe we should extend bioavailability to brownfield sites? And then they've gone on to say, if the CDC recommendation drops
the soil screening level. Sorry, our thing is refreshing here. I apologize. Here we go.
Okay. And if CDC recommendation drops the soil screening level to 250 parts per million, don't we almost have to consider bioavailability? We need to conserve our soil resources in urban areas instead of soil replacement.
Right. Well,
and that was from Nick Basta, Mark.
Okay, I know. Yeah. Okay. Hello, Nick. If you're listening, it's been a while. I couldn't agree more with Nick. We should be using bioavailability for all, for all risk assessments for soil-borne lead, not just under certain labels of Superfund or RCRA or something else. I always thought it did apply to the brownfields myself, and I think even outside of Superfund, because I actually don't even work in the Superfund program, but I think it's best risk assessment practices. We know that the bioavailability of lead in soil will vary depending on the source of the lead, the form of the lead, and a lot of the soil characteristics as well, and we should try to characterize that to give ourselves the best risk assessment. And, this is something that, Rufus has pointed out on a number of occasions that, we have a default bioavailability for lead in soil of 30%. And, again, it's a central tendency estimate and it's, often will be greater or lesser than that. And I think Rufus makes the point, and I entirely agree, that garden soils are almost certainly likely to be lower because they have all the things in them that tend to reduce bioavailability in soil, high organic content. And what do you do with your garden? You fertilize it. Fertilizer's got phosphate. We know phosphates stabilize lead and reduce the leachability, and we're going to be doing some additional studies to show that they, in fact, not that lead gets taken up into plants that well to begin with, but it reduces it even further. So, yeah, I often think that, you know, when we're doing the pathway analysis that I just described a few moments ago, we're looking at the potential lead intake from plant up, you know, that was associated with eating produce that was grown in lead contaminated soil. And one of the things I just said, you know, there seemed to be a disconnect between what our potential lead exposure was and what our community-wide or nationwide blood lead values are. I said, we seem to be over-predicting. And I think the reason, one of the areas is probably a number of them, just assuming too much homegrown produce intake and so on and so forth. But I think a big one is that we're probably overestimating the bioavailability of lead in soil, especially from garden soil, which is, as I said, highly fertilized and has high organic material. So yeah, I agree with Nick. We should be doing more of this. And right now we have very easy tools. We have in vitro tests. You don't have to go out and dose an animal and do a bioassay to find out what the bioavailability of lead in soil is. You just do a very quick and easy in vitro test, and you know we accept that as indicative of bioavailability.
Okay, Mark, thanks very much. I just want to make one last statement from one of our questioners before we move on to the rest of the presentation. And actually, Rufus Cheney raised an issue. I wanted to bring that up, that raised beds can become recontaminated by dust from exterior lead paint on neighbors' housing, et cetera. And in a few years, a raised bed garden in Boston went from background to over 500 ppm in surface soil. So I think the idea is that a raised bed isn't the end of your problems, and have to be vigilant and have to do it as carefully as you do other things.
I just mentioned something similar. We were out in Staten Island where we found, it was like an old 60s type of commune. And, they looked like they were doing a real good job with their homegrown produce there. But, we had their raised beds tested, and they came out over 1,000. So.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks. Let's move on and finish up. That was great. I thank our commenters for their questions, and I thank our panel. I just want to wrap up today's discussion by introducing an SRI tool that could potentially be a resource to help get an urban gardening project up and running. And now I'm on slide 75. So SRI provides communities with resources that include startup funds and expert support to help communities determine what future uses are possible. And this support comes in the form of regional seed. I just realized what a pun that was on this topic, but comes in the form of regional seed projects that are highly adaptable to the needs of communities. So our community support information pages on the SRI website provides examples of the reports generated through reuse planning. And I encourage you all to look at those reports. And if you think a site in your community could benefit from EPA's help, there is a contact slide toward the end of this presentation that lists who you can call. Slide 76, just to take a very quick, closer look at regional seeds, the photo and maps on this slide are from the John Garland site, where we help the community consider reuse options, including agricultural uses on the site. John Garland Park is a former municipal landfill in Kansas City, Kansas, and the Kansas Department of Health is currently overseeing long-term operation and maintenance activities. But after the landfill's closure, there was a public park that had ball fields, basketball courts, a playground, and picnic shelter, and the construction of all this was part of the original plan. But there were a lot of community concerns about environmental health and safety, so the park was actually closed after it was cleaned up. And the community around the site requested EPA's assistance in determining an appropriate future use. And so EPA gave them a regional seed to do a reuse assessment to evaluate the site's suitability for future use. And the reuse assessment explored installing low impact community uses that would be compatible with long-term operation and maintenance of the landfill, such as hiking trails, greenhouses, native prairie grasses, bird habitat restoration, and educational opportunities. So there's a lot of interest in what had happened and whether it was really ready for people, and even though there had been a lot of cleanup done, people were still not certain about what to do, and they didn't feel safe. So the Reeves assessment helped to move that project along. I also wanted to just list some links that I think will be helpful. You can download some of the resources. I'm sorry, I'm on page 77, where you can download some of the resources we've talked about today, and certainly we're all open. And on page 78, every region, every EPA region has a Superfund Redevelopment Regional Coordinator. So we have names here of people and their phone numbers and their emails. And they work with EPA staff and site stakeholders on redevelopment issues. Feel free to contact your regional coordinator with questions. And page 79, I put my contact information, Michelle's contact information, along with Frank Avasato. Please don't hesitate to be in touch with any of us. We all have a lot of information we're happy to share. And I think on that note, I'm going to just close the presentation portion, and let's see if we have any more questions that we can do.
And Melissa, before we go look at the questions that are coming in, I want to direct the participants to look at slide 80. And this is the link to the feedback form that I mentioned a couple times during the presentation. And we really appreciate it if you take the time to complete the feedback form. Let us know what you think of today's webinar and any ideas you might have for some future webinars, because we do take a look at these in planning our events. And then I also, after you're done doing that, please move on to slide 81, and you'll see that CLUIN is now on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, so you can follow updates to our website and information from these social media sources, too. So just want to put a plug in for that.
We have a couple of questions where people were asking for more information, so we'll be able to follow up with you after the webinar. There are people who've asked for more information about case studies and things like that. Okay. We have a question on
More of a comment.
A comment, actually, on decking material, I guess, for raised beds. And someone has written in, the plastic decking material is a good choice for, I guess, raised beds because it is more durable than the wood and would reduce the, rot, essentially.
Yeah, and
reduce
waste.
The amount of waste from not having to replace regular wood. So I think that's very helpful. Thank you. Okay. And let's see. Someone has written in about what someone else has said.
This was in regards to that question. We needed some clarification. So.
Okay. Currently, EPA is reviewing the residential. Didn't we answer that?
Well, I think you can read that one.
Okay. Currently, EPA is reviewing the residential soil level of 400 ppm and considering lowering that value. So the level of 500 ppm currently does not meet federal residential soil levels. Also, where appropriate in Region 4, lead-impacted soil is removed to a depth of approximately 2 feet and then replaced with, in quotes, clean soil, which has been tested for lead. Let's see. And the typical plant root system reaches approximately 8 inches. Okay.
Did you want to make any comments on that, Mark?
No, that sounds that's I've heard sounds.
Yeah,
right.
I think that helps clarify that questioner. So thank you for that, Luke. If anyone has any more questions coming in, please submit them. We still have a couple minutes. Rufus just made a comment. He wants people to keep in mind that the 400 ppm is for bare soil and play areas for children, and 1200 ppm for grasses or other non-play areas. So thanks, Rufus. since we have time and Mark, you're on the phone, I don't know if you want to address this one question here. My computer's doing something weird here. It says slightly off topic, but I know we kind of maybe expected that a question might come up related to this. But this questioner wants to know if you can give a prediction of the TRW's and EPA's reaction to the CDC's new target blood lead recommendations, and if we think the residential lead level will be lowered. And then this relates back to what that other commenter made about EPA reviewing those levels. I don't know if you want to make any comments at this point about that, but I thought since someone asked, we should bring it up.
Well, of course, I'm going to have to preface this strongly by, you know, the standard, this is not EPA policy, and cite or quote, blah, blah, blah. But EPA will almost certainly embrace the CDC recommendations to some extent, and I think we'll target, we probably will, embrace that goal of 5 micrograms per deciliter as opposed to the current policy of 10, which itself is based on CDC recommendations. So if we can just continue to be consistent and base our own policies on CDC's recommendations, that's probably where we'll go. And as some people have commented, it will reduce the cleanup goal for lead in soil down into the 200 parts per million range. And so while a lot of people are interested in phosphate amendments to soil, I think that's even going to be an impetus to further understand and possibly utilize amending agents, because no one was of the impression that amending agents are a cure-all, and that they, even though I've heard this in the popular press saying that, nullify your lead problems or eliminate them with, spread a little phosphate around you, and ta-da, your lead problems are gone. It's certainly by no means that effective. But so, if you have heavily contaminated soil, you're probably have little choice but then to probably remove it or restrict access. But if you have modestly contaminated soil, which we were probably talking about before CDC guidelines of maybe anything above 400 or residential soil standard up to maybe 1,000 or so, phosphate amendments would be one possible way of dealing with that. And now I think with the CDC recommendations pushing us even lower, some people might also be considering phosphate amendments that, say soil lead levels between 200 and 400. So I think we're going to see even more interest in the use of amending agents. And they're not entirely all phosphate based. I know Rufus actually has done a lot of work with sewer sludge and some other biosolids. So.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, we have another question on PAHs. Somebody's asked, Mark, I'll throw this over to you for starters. What about PAHs? Should they be tested?
Well, in urban areas, we have pretty high levels of PAHs, but, I'm a pragmatist. We're probably going to get a fair amount of PAHs if you charboil a hamburger. So I don't know that, you want to go crazy. Unless you really think you have a significant pH problem. Like if you're putting your garden a few feet from a bus stop, you're probably going to have a pH problem in your yard. But otherwise, I don't know if I would get that aggressive with that. Because first of all, the pHs, they're organic and they won't break down over time as opposed to lead, which is an element and doesn't. And, there was another point that I wanted to make with that. And the other thing is PAH is a more expensive analysis. It's not one compound. It's a whole host of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. So it'd be much, much more expensive to do a soil PAH analysis than it would to do a soil lead. So I would not recommend routine PAH testing. Yeah, if you have that raised bed that's made of creosote-containing rail ties, you might want to consider it.
Rufus just put a follow-up comment on. He's stating that if pHs are your concern, you don't want to grow carrots or leafy vegetables, but other crops don't accumulate pHs in the edible tissues. So his suggestion is to add high organic matter in order to reduce the pH mobility. So thanks, Rufus.
That sounds like excellent advice.
It does.
Okay, and then I think we have one more comment that's come in. Someone has suggested that soil testing should be done periodically for nutrients, and that we should add heavy metal testing to the request, and that the extension service does a good job with its initial test. So work with your extensions on the testing. I think that's a great
And they particularly mentioned the University of Massachusetts, which does some heavy metal testing. And this is one of the things that we try to explain to folks who get their soil tested, and then they show it to us, and really they just had the soil nutrients tested in it, and there was no metal analysis at all. So we're trying to do a lot of education on that, letting people know to ask the questions about what the soil what they're actually testing the soil for, and if it is the things that you might be concerned about. So I think that was a really great point.
Okay. I think we're going to close at this point. Let me thank my panel again. Thank the questioners. I hope you've gotten a bigger picture about reuse and an even bigger picture about urban gardening, and that there's a lot of research and a lot of people out there willing to help, and we hope that you found this encouraging, and nothing is simple, but there's a lot of guidance out there to help you out. And we encourage you to look at all the material that is available. I thank you for participating in our webinar. We do these approximately every other month. And stay tuned to look at Clue In to see an announcement for our next topic. So thank you very much, everybody.